Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome to this third lecture on principles of banking. I'm very much used to say that the early birds catch the best worms, so I hope you are awake already. Okay, so let's continue the first of all, some of you asked yesterday after the lecture that when are these going to be, these recordings, when are these going to be submitted to the Moodle. Each and every week after the last lecture, I will convert these files to the appropriate form and then send them to the Moniviestin, and then from Moniviestin get the link in Moodle that you can then read the watch the videos there. So these are available for you throughout the course, at least until the end of this year, so that you can read and recap all the time the things that you have been taught. Okay, so let's continue from this discussion about the ideas regarding calculating the returns in the interest yielding asset market. So when people speak about interests or interest rates in the general media, for example, you have to understand that there are various definitions for interest rates. And you are mainly interested about the return to maturity. Because you are, as an investor, you are participating in the interest of the asset markets. You have a certain holding period that you are prepared to hold the asset. So based on the information that you have there at your hands when you make the investment decision, try to calculate the current discounted value for your investment. Regarding the discounting behavior in stock markets, I downloaded yesterday the working paper version of my most recent achievement in terms of research. So you can take a look at the simple discounting model in stock markets from that. It's called the Gordon discount, dividend discount model, and I relate that, let's say, that's that theoretical framework, whether does it work in current conditions when we have experienced these negative interest rates for a long period of time already. Because interest yielding assets are one of the key determinants in calculating also the real rates of return or the discounted value of stock market returns or stock market valuation for you. Real rate of interest is should be one of the key ingredients in discounting also in the stock markets. But in the interest yielding asset markets, it's a bit easier to calculate. Just use the information about the fixed coupons in the future that are going to mature during your investment holding period. And then the redemption value of the asset that you are trying to invest on. Calculate the discounted value. And then make the prediction regarding your own required rate of return. Are you trying to get the 5% year rate of return or what? What is the discounted value for your investment at that time? Make a decision after that. Okay, so in practice, we have observed that prices and returns for long-term bonds are more volatile than those for short-term bonds. And we have theoretical explanation for that. At the end of this lecture, I will give you a set of slides that you have to read independently regarding the term structure of interest rates. But already from this basic idea regarding the volatility of interest rates at different maturities, you should be aware that the first thing that is most important for you in very short term is the liquidity of the asset. How easy it is to transfer that proceedings of that asset to plain cash to be used in your consumption. So that's the key thing at the very short end. Then things get much more problematic. The longer is your investment horizon, the longer are the maturities of the bonds that you are interested in, because things can change. Okay. But in terms of these theoretical ideas of discounting, there is no interest rate risk for any bond whose time to maturity matches the holding period exactly. That's one of the key things that you should understand. But as an economist or as a very sophisticated investor, financial banker in the markets, you should be interested about real values. Nominal interest rates are the ones that are being quoted in the markets, in the financial media all the time, financial news. But as an investor, you should be interested about the possibilities of increasing your real consumption based on your savings behavior and investments. So the real rates of interest should be the ones that you are interested about. And that is actually the basic idea also in that stock market dividend discount model. The real rate of interest is the key thing. And the future prospects for increasing the dividend streams by the firms are mainly dictated by the real economic performance of those firms. Are they doing well in their businesses? So are they able to pay you dividends? And that is dependent on the real economic aggregate level activity. And that is the very much, let's say, troublesome thing or animal in the overall economies at the moment. That is the main reason why the firms are facing bankruptcies in the near future, because the economy is not working properly at the moment. Everything is going down. Okay, but then another distinction that you have to be careful in terms of using these models, these valuation models, you have to always be very careful in making a distinction between ex-ante values and exposed values. Exposed values are the ones that you are able to observe only after you have observations of everything. Ex-ante is something that involves expectations. And when you calculate the real interest rates in ex-ante terms, the thing that is most, even in the cases when you have a fixed interest rate stream coming from an investment, inflation rate can change. And inflation rate, by definition, determines the real interest rate. So you have to form some kind of expectations about inflation. This is a small thing in overall terms in all these equilibrium relationships, but it's very important. What is the expected inflation in the economy? Because the central banks are also focusing on that. It's very low at the moment. So basically, in high-yielding interest rate markets where nominal interest rates are actually fairly high, in Western standards at the moment, it's about 3 or 4%. That is very high nominal interest rate. But when the inflation rate is very close to zero, then the ex-ante interest rates, real interest rates, are also very close to the nominal rates. So expectations are very smooth at the moment regarding the inflation rate, because actual inflation is very smooth. And I did actually one of my articles in my PhD thesis about the formation of inflation expectations based on simple autoregressive time series models. So basically at the starting point, I don't have any other information than the past history of inflation rates. I try to forecast those future values based on that. Okay. Actually, that paper, I could download also that, because this is very interesting and important for me, because it was one part of my dissertation, modeling the inflation rate expectations in the Finnish economy after the liberalization of money markets. And it's actually a very good paper. It has been prepared quite a lot. It's published in the International Journal of Forecast. I can download that also to the Moodle site if you want to take a look at that. But nevertheless, this was the guy that I was interested in my one article in my PhD thesis. So it gives you an idea as a definition for the calculation of real interest rate. So normally you are more like used to using this equation in the form that the real rate of interest rate is there in the left-hand side, and by definition you are able to calculate that as a difference between the nominal ex-post interest rate and some kind of view about future development of inflation. that is the pi e here. But in my dissertation, I noticed that this is way different from just the definition, because it involves a huge amount of uncertainty regarding this inflation expectation variables. And this is actually something that has been focused on very tightly in modern central banks over 20 years already. They try to stabilize the future path of inflation. So they try to stabilize inflation expectations. And by definition, that is the key animal here in the calculation of real rates of interest. So it's a thing that has an effect on all kinds of discounting behavior in all markets. So that is one of the reasons why it's so important in central bank target functions. Some of you took a look at that, Mrs. Reinhardt's lecture. She was discussing about inflation expectations heavily there. So this is actually the background for that discussion. Why is it so important? It's important in the discounting behavior of all the agents, because the main incentive should be the real consumption possibilities that you are only able to increase in the future if you get more in real terms from your savings than you would get now. Okay. So when the real interest rate is low, there are greater incentives to borrow and fewer incentives to lend. What would this indicate? This simple, let's stop here for this simple equation. What does this indicate in the situation of negative nominal interest rates? If this guy here on the left-hand side of this definition here, actually this is in full meaning, this is a regression equation because it involves lots of uncertainty regarding this right-hand side variable. But what can you say about this Fisher equation? When you have negative interest rates, what would that indicate in at least fairly normal situation without deflation, lowering general levels of prices, lowering general levels of prices? What would that indicate to the real rate of interest? Is it more negative, more positive, zero? What does it indicate? It's more negative. So in terms of these incentives ideas, what would this indicate? If we have a negative real rate of interest, it's very low. It's extremely low. It should be an incentive to all the agents to borrow more and consume more, not save, but consume more now. And this is the key idea, actually, in all the actions that the central banks are now doing in the form of monetary policy actions and especially in the form of unconventional monetary policy actions. They are issuing more money, more and more money, by buying the assets of the banks, banking sector that they have nowadays, also in the form of government bonds, for example. They are lowering the real rate of interest de facto. So the main idea also in the unconventional monetary policy actions is actually this functioning of this Fisher equation. It should be clearly an incentive to the older agents to borrow more and consume more, get the real economic activity to be higher again at the moment. So it's just not only a better indicator of the incentives to borrow and lend, it should be the main indicator. Don't focus too much on nominal interest rate, focus on real interest rate, because that is the key thing. And here we have some historical figures, or one historical figure about the development of real interest rates and nominal interest rates. And here, this is from the US economy. So the nominal interest rate has hit the zero lower bound here. by the end of 2008 already. And by definition, the Federal Reserve does not allow any quoted market interest rates, money market interest rates, go below zero at the moment. Discussions about changing that framework also in the US are going on at the moment. And it's very much dependent on the survivalship story of the European or the Euro area, whether these negative interest rates help in recovering from this huge shock that we now have. In terms of economic theories, I very much question this, actually, because it is a disaster in terms of discounting behavior. It doesn't work at the moment. It's something that's very, very difficult to understand. Why are people behaving like this? Even though you can get loans at the very low loan rates from the banks, you're not willing to do that because the uncertainty is too large, too big in the overall economies. Okay, so uncertainty related, in my stock market discounting paper that I downloaded, David Moodle, the uncertainty variables regarding near-term future stock market uncertainty and overall macroeconomic uncertainty play actually a big role in terms of discounting the real rate and real growth of economy to the stock market values, and especially the quantile, the highest levels of uncertainty, the highest 5% at the extreme end of the distribution of these uncertainty measures are the ones that are the important. And that is the main result from my paper. I'm every day writing that, some parts of that paper again. I try to submit that with a colleague from Australia to a very good journal because the story is very strong and I have got the results based on very simple regression models. Nothing too fancy, standard models in terms of theory, just an idea that the uncertainty plays now a huge role in discounting behavior. So that's the main message there. So let's go to this analysis of determinants of asset demand. In this course, we try to put into pieces everything that's related to the demand for assets and supply of those. In terms of money market assets and the steering interest rates in monetary policy, the main idea is that the main important actor in these markets is the central bank. It's providing the liquidity in various forms of assets to the other sectors in the economy. So economic agents hold a variety of different assets. What are the primary assets you hold? An asset is anything that can be owned and has a value. You have to somehow be able to get the price for that asset. And the market mechanism is the one that we use for that. So it always involves persons that want to demand that asset and others that want to supply. And the price is the thing that adapts to the disequilibrium between supply and demand. Okay, so we have already discussed about these definitions. Now we introduce some more. Risk is one of the important things that we introduce here. You will get to be introduced all these things in much more details in other courses, but already from the theoretical point of view, you have to here make a distinction between, first of all, wealth. So wealth is allocated to different forms of assets. You can own an apartment, house, forest, interest yielding assets, stock market assets, derivatives market assets, currencies. Even currencies can be denoted to be financial assets because there's a supply and demand of those. And you can make a profit by trading very actively and being aware of the main fundamentals that determine the prices of currencies. You will be taught, guys will be teaching those to you in the international finance course, for example. And then, from a theoretical point of view, expected return and risk are the ones that get to be involved into optimal decisions regarding allocations. You either want to maximize your expected return from an individual asset or a set of assets as a portfolio with a given level of risk, or you want to minimize the risk with a given level of expected return. In very sophisticated models, you can even try to do both. Try to maximize the expected returns at the same time that you are minimizing the risk. But from the standard, let's say, traditional pricing models point of view, it's easier to start from fixing the other one of these to be constant. Because all of you have some kind of risk profiles. You don't want your portfolio assets, the value of your assets in your portfolio to vary too much, or you are prepared to some kind of variation in those if you are being rewarded with the higher expected return from those. Okay. Then the liquidity in terms of especially the interest yielding asset markets is also very important. If you compare interest yielding asset markets to stock markets, stock market assets should be at the origin, they should be more like long-term investments, but in the interest rate markets, you actually might be interested in getting the proceeds very soon. So liquidity plays a big role there. And by definition, it just means the ease and speed with which an asset can be turned into cash. And this is for your consumption. This is related to your consumption incentive. You want to consume all the time. Okay, so in economic analysis, we always have to use simplifications because we cannot analyze things in a situation where everything change at the same time. It's much too complicated to try to find a so-called final or closed form solution for these kind of optimization problems. In economic analysis, we usually use this ceteris paribus assumption, which means that we assume that only one thing changes at the time and others remain the same for that when we want to analyze this effect of this one variable change on the thing that we are interested about. So here are some very simple ideas about the supply and demand analysis for the asset yielding asset markets. So the quantity of demanded of an asset is positively related to wealth. So in theoretical terms, some of you might be interested about mathematics in this kind of idea. So we draw a demand function for an asset as a function of wealth first. W is the first thing that is interesting to us. The second thing is the expected return. So RE is the second thing. And then the third thing is the riskiness of the return. And the fourth thing is the liquidity. So now we have a demand function that is determined by four factors. We are interested about the partial derivatives of that function in mathematical terms. So if we are saying that the quantity demanded of an asset is positively related to wealth, then the partial derivative of demand function for that asset is positive regarding changes in wealth. When the overall wealth increases, demand for each and every asset should be increased. So assets are considered as kind of a normal goods in terms of economics analysis. For those of you that have a background from your bachelor's thesis in economics, you know what's the idea of normal goods. When your income increases, the demand for that good usually at the aggregate level at least increases. So asset is here considered as a normal good. Then the quantity demanded of an asset is positively related to its expected return. This is intuitively very understandable. If the expected return increases, you are willing to invest more. So demand is the partial derivative of demand of that asset is positive regarding expected return. But for the riskiness of that asset, you are not willing to invest more to that asset if it's more risky in the future. So the partial derivative with respect to risk, and it's usually measured based on variance or standard deviation of the returns. If the partial derivative for that guy is negative, then the quantity demanded decreases when the risk increases. And finally, liquidity is related to your consumption purposes. So the easier is it to liquidate your proceeds from the investment, the more you want to demand that specific asset. So these are sort of a list of main incentives for any kind of assets that you are willing to invest in. Okay, so here we can draw this in the simple form of table. I don't want to use that mathematical denotation at the moment because most of you are not familiar with these partial derivatives or these kind of things, but you can, as easily, you can describe these relationships based on this table. The main thing here is that you assume that when you are analyzing the effects of changes in wealth on the asset demand, nothing else changes, just wealth changes. And if you are analyzing the changes of expected return, nothing else changes. So ceteris paribus applies to all the other things here. So in that case, you are able to analyze the partial effects of each and every factor that has an effect on the demand of that individual asset. Okay, so here we show only the increases in the variables, and the decreases are changes based on the decreases of these factor variables are analogous to the other direction, obviously. Okay, so then about the supply. What is the reason for supplying bonds to the markets? Who are the suppliers of bonds? Yeah. Firms are supplying the bonds, governments are supplying the bonds, and financial institutions in general are supplying the bonds, the bonds. But in general terms, they are the agents that are in need for funding. They have a demand for funding on the markets. And the funding is organized in the form of bonds in this case, when we are talking about interest-earning asset markets. So here you have to remember that discounting behavior, that equation that I wrote you yesterday, at lower prices, which is analogous to higher interest rates, ceteris paribus, once again, the quantity demanded of bond is higher, there's an inverse relationship. This is, should be intuitive. In terms of any kind of good market equilibriums, the lower is the price of the good that you want to have, the more you want to have that, obviously. But in this case, when we are analyzing assets that have interest rates as the return on interest yields, you have to remember that they are in a negative relationship between each other, prices and interest rates. When the prices go up, interest rates come down. When the prices go down, interest rates go up. Okay. So at lower prices, which is analogous to higher interest rates, the quantity supplied of bonds is lower. What is the intuition behind that? Firms do not want to supply bonds so much at lower prices. Why? There's a higher interest rate that they have to pay to the investors, and obviously at lower prices from the same amount of nominal amount of bonds or number of bonds, you get lower funding for your real investment purposes. That's an easy interpretation of this. And the other thing is that they know, they are able to understand that lower prices are in connection to higher interest rates. Well, this is very simple actually to understand also in terms of the government bonds, for example. The countries that are in deep troubles in terms of that public dynamic public sector constraint that we discussed yesterday, the day before that. The quotation for their secondary market quotation for their government bonds are very low. So they have to pay high interest rates to get the investors to be even interested about those assets. There are lots of discussion about this recovery package with the European Union. And now we are taking a common loan from the markets, as I said, European Union countries. My skepticism regarding that thing is based on the idea that why didn't we first give all the countries that are in troubles at the moment the possibility to get the funding first from the actual government bond markets. And then only after that, go there and save those that are not able to get the funding. Why didn't we try first just a market-based solution for these things? Because the decrease of all the needs for, let's say, needs for this funding are very different in different countries. For example, in the Finnish case, we have very good credit ratings for our government bonds at the moment. We would have been able to get also the funding perhaps from the markets fairly easily without paying very much higher interest rates. Because our situation in the corona, the overall corona situation is actually very good compared to many other countries. But we have done the decision regarding those things ourselves. So why are we not rewarded from that? Why didn't we use a market-based solution? That's something that people are now discussing. The Finnish Parliament is going to be discussing about these things this week. And it's going to be difficult. It will not be passed in this form that people are now suggesting. And one of the things that they have completely forgotten at the moment is the role of sovereign markets at the individual country level. How much funding could have those countries obtained from the markets without the need of European level help first? That would have been a market-based solution. One of the journalists asked actually about this during the summertime for me, and I told this, but he was not able to publish that at that moment because the discussions were too heavy at that moment. But it's always the case that you should first try to get the market-based solution, because that would be on a sound play, sound, let's say, formation in reforms. So, we'll see what happens. But nevertheless, this is the simple idea that is going on there in the markets also. Also regarding these loans that we get, because we have to get those from the markets at the European level now, the salvage package. So the main idea here is about the demand and supply of these bonds. So this line that goes upward here is the supply of bonds. The only thing that you have to sort of realize from this or understand from this is that as the price is higher, the agents are willing to supply more bonds because they got more funding for their needs. They want to use the funding obtained from the bond market for their needs. And this applies also to the salvage package bonds that have to be issued at the European Union level now. This is the first time that we are issuing these things. But in the demand side, we have a dilemma there because the demanders are not willing to buy so much at higher prices. And you have to remember now that this is the difficult thing for students at the first stage to understand, but we have been discussing about this quite a lot. You usually forget this during 2 years when you start doing your thesis. You don't remember this simple discounting idea, but try to remember that this from now on. So the higher is the price, the lower is the interest rate that is connected to that price. And so we draw both these here in the vertical axis. And in the horizontal axis, we have the quantity of bonds. And the simple thing here is the equilibrium that determines the equilibrium quantity, amount of bonds, that is being demanded and supplied at the certain equilibrium level of prices. So in this case, the price level is 850, and it's in connection in the markets to the very high interest rate of 17.6. And these are usually quoted in per annum quotations. So they are annual interest rates. Here in this line segment, we are discussing about an excess supply of bonds. There's an excess supply because at this price level, that is in connection to this interest rate, people are not willing to buy the bonds, the amount that the suppliers are willing to supply. So this is a disequilibrium situation. The guy here that adopts to this thing is the price of the bonds. It starts to go down towards the equilibrium situation, and vice versa. In this case, the line between F and E points is denoting the amount of excess demand, because the demand curve point is E here. It's in connection to the amount of 500, and the supply here is F, and it's in connection to the amount of $100 billion in this case. So there's an excess demand. Once again, the thing that has to adapt to this situation is the price. This is the simple thing that you now, I encourage you to start focusing in the financial press or financial. I can even send you some sites where to follow the daily quotations of government bond markets, because it's starting to be an interesting thing at the moment, because there are these negotiations about the form of the EU level first common EU level bond. What kind of bond would it be? Is it a coupon bond? Is it a zero coupon bond? What is it? What's the maturity of that? No idea. We would have had these things ready at the sovereign level already, but now we have to formulate something completely new. So we need that, some kind of package. But I would have very much liked to have seen that we would have first tried this sovereign level, individual country level survivorships through the debt markets. Each and every country at the global level has to take more debt in this situation, at least in short term. Okay, so the market equilibrium is there. We discussed already these situations where the demand is higher than supply, there's excess demand. Where demand is smaller than supply, there's excess supply. So the things that are of interest to you, the ceteris paribus, things that are allowed to change one at a time, and you're interested about their effects on the demand and supply. Things that change the demand. And you have to understand now that we are discussing about all the time about the things that move the whole demand curve. They move the whole demand curve. So they are exogenous things that have an effect. Wealth is the first thing in an expansionary situation with growing wealth. The demand curve for bonds shifts to the right. Ceteris paribus also involves assumption that the supply doesn't change. Obviously, if the demand curve goes right, then the equilibrium point will be different with the same supply function or the supply curve. The second one was expected returns. Higher expected interest rates in the future lower the expected return for long-term bonds, shifting the demand curve to the left. Okay? This comes from the discounting idea, okay? So the expected return goes down, okay? Then expected inflation comes through the Fisher effect or the Fisher equation that we discussed about. You are not only interested about expected nominal returns, you should be interested about expected real returns. So in that case, expected inflation has a role. Riskiness of the assets is one of the things that has an effect. An increase in the riskiness of bonds causes the demand curve shift to the left. At each and every price level, people are willing to demand less of those assets because they are more risky. Okay, and then the liquidity, increased liquidity of bonds results in the demand curve shifting right. Liquidity is mostly determined by the number of participants in that specific market segment for that bond. How many are there demanders and how many are there suppliers? What's the amount of volume for those assets? That's a loose definition for the liquidity. How easy it is to get rid of that asset for the purposes of changing that to a cash and using that cash for consumption. That's liquidity. If there are many market participants participating to the market at the moment, then it's easier. Okay. So we will analyze all these in individual slides, individual figures, because we still assume this ceteris paribus assumption. We assume that only one thing at a time increases. Obviously, the actual situation is such that when for some reason or other, the, let's say, general wealth increases, then it might be in connection to the overall real activity increases, and it might be in connection to the central bank view that it's too active, it's too high. So they want to engage into monetary policy actions, tightening monetary policy action. They don't want the real activity to be so strong. So it will have an effect also on interest rates and inflation rates. So in practice, these things, at least in a bit longer term, they do change more or less in a continuous pattern. When something changes, the other things start to react to that. Okay, but nevertheless, you just have to understand that an increase in the demand for bonds implies that the whole demand curve goes to the right. The whole demand curve. And the new situation is possible to be analyzed if nothing happens in the supply, you are able to find the new equilibrium points in different price levels and interest rate levels and quantity levels. Okay, so here is the collection of all the things that change the position of the demand curve. This is just a recollection of the ideas that we have been discussing in the past slides. So if wealth increases, it goes to the right. If expected interest rate increases, it goes to the left, based on the discounting idea. This is the first part where you have to think about a bit in not, let's say, not standard ways, not intuitively. You have to remember the discounting idea. When expected inflation changes, when it increases, you have to remember the Fisher identity. It has an effect on the real rates, so it will shift the demand curve to the left. And riskiness of bonds relative to other assets, so this is all always in relative terms. Ceteris paribus idea applies here. Also to the riskiness of other assets, then it goes to the left. And if the liquidity increases, it goes to the right. Okay. These are the things that you somehow have to always bear in mind. What is happening in the markets now? If we issue these new European Union level bonds, who are the investors that might be interested on those? Do you have any idea of that?
Institutions, yeah.
Yeah. Institutions, financial institutions, institutional investors that need to diversify their portfolios. But usually in this situation, they are going to be exactly the same institutions that would have bought the sovereign bonds. Okay, so what is the reason for having these European Union level bonds right now? Basically, we have a situation that, for example, the foreign governments are not probably able to buy other governments' bonds. So mainly the demand should come from already wealthy institutions, and the wealthy institutions are the banking firms and these institutional bank-type funds that have lots of liquidity in their balance sheets due to these huge central bank buying programs. So they would be the buyers. And exactly the same guys would have bought the sovereign bonds also. But it would have been giving them much more possibilities to diversify their portfolios because there would have been different rates of interest. Now we have a common rate of interest or the yield or the price for the European level bond. What are the incentives for financial institutions to get too much engaged into that? They would have been able to diversify their portfolios much more if we would have done this through the individual sovereign markets. And the European Union could have been providing, for example, collateral for those. But basically, it's very close to actually going to the common bond stage now in terms of getting the money. Okay, but these are the things that you have to now think in the very near future when we are going to experience this first time the European Union level bonds in the primary markets. The interesting thing is that what is going to happen in the secondary markets for those bonds? What are going to be the price quotations compared to, let's say, the US bonds or the Chinese bonds or any other bonds that are there possible to be purchased from those markets? What is going to be the optimal equilibrium price level and the interest rate level for that? Is it determined based on the very bad countries, the southern European countries that already have a lot of default premium in their government bond quotations? Or is it the interest rate is going to be dictated by the northern countries, like Finland, that have a negative interest rate on their government? That's an interesting thing. Okay. What are the determinants that have an effect on the supply of bonds? Expected profitability of investment opportunities. And now we are here discussing about these uses of funds. Why do the bond suppliers want to have the funding? They want to have the funding for the purposes of, for example, building railroads, other traffic facilities, and firms want to build new factories and so on. In an expansionary state of the economy, the supply curve shifts to the right because it's profitable to build new factories and so on. Expected inflation is a common factor. Why? It's a common factor in demand and supply behavior, the asset markets. Why is it a common factor?
Expected real returns.
Yeah, exactly. The expected real returns are the thing that are important, here because the cost of real investments goes down when expected inflation goes up. It's not so costly to build the new factories when the real rate of interest that you have to pay to the investors from your bond is not so high through higher inflation expectations. The same thing, Fisher hypothesis. This is one of the reasons why I was prepared to even give more than 1 year of time in my PhD thesis for examining this Fisher hypothesis. Does it work or not? And then the government budget for the part of bond markets is very important. So increased budget deficits shift the supply curve to the right. You should understand this from that discussion regarding the intertemporal government budget constraint that we discussed already on Monday. Because nowadays it's actually important also in monetary policies and central banks discussions and activities. So increased budget deficits shift the supply curve to the right because governments need more debt. They have to fund the increasing deficits based on taking more debt from the markets. And this is the primary channel for the needs of these European Union level bond programs at the moment, because the individual government, country level government budgets are going to a strong deficit now for many years. The Finnish government is Finnish government budget is forecasted to be at the -7.5% deficit for this year. So it's very high compared to the last year's value, that was around 1.5. So it's very high. But we hope that it would be a short-term experience. But I would have very much liked to see the situation that, because our corona situation is very good and the government is doing their best to keep the economy going on all the time, that we would have been given the possibility to mainly get the funding from the international markets based on sovereign bonds, our own bonds, more bonds of Finnish government to the markets. Now we are more or less committed to the using this European Union package. Otherwise, we would be bad guys to go only solely to the sovereign bond markets. So that would not be a good in terms of reputation of our country at the European Union level. So our hands are now a bit more tied. Okay, then shifts in the supply of bonds. What these are the three things collected to the same figure. This is just the recap of those ideas. So we have only here cases where the shift in the supply curve is to the right. Profitability investments moves that to right, and expected inflation, if they go higher, then it goes right because of the lowering cost of real cost of funding, and then government deficit has the same effect. So an increase in the supply of bonds shifts the bond supply curve to the right. So basically the situation that we are interested about is this kind of situation, that if something happens in the markets for some reason or other, what would happen to the equilibrium? So the blue lines here are the starting positions for these figures. There comes, for some reason or other, a sudden rise in expected inflation. Let's assume, for example, an exceptional shock might be that for some reason or other, let's say the price of oil increases suddenly. It would be something that even nowadays has an effect on expected inflation. So it's a shock that comes to the bond markets also, because it affects the real rates of interest. And that was the one animal that has an effect on both the supply and demand of bonds. Okay? So at the first step, it shifts the bond demand curve to left, okay? Because the real ex ante rate of interest from bonds goes lower through the Fisher effect. And in the second step, we have to realize that it will also have an effect on the incentives of the suppliers of bonds. It will shift the bond supply curve to the other direction. So if we were to be able to get to a new equilibrium situation in the overall bond markets, the price should adapt. It should adapt to this new situation. So the new curves are here, the red bond demand curve and the red bond supply curve. So the only thing, if we are assuming that in equilibrium we would be willing to trade the same amount of bonds, then something has to happen to the price of bonds. It has to go down. So the new red lines cross here at the lower level of prices, but with the same amount of bonds. So if we were determined to be trading the same amount of bonds in the markets after this shock, then the price should adapt. This is the first idea of the simple supply and demand analysis that we will be using all in our analysis here. So basically, at the other side of the coin, what should happen to the interest rate? It goes upwards because the price comes down, the incentive for the demanders of the bonds should increase, and it can be only increased through the increases in the interest rate. If the interest rate increases enough to completely meet the rise in expected inflation, then the real rate of interest stays the same, for the example, real rate of interest. So it has to adapt also. And in some cases, people mix up these two things, the prices of bonds and interest rates of bonds. In some cases, they consider the interest rate as a price of bond. No. Remember right from the beginning that everything starts from the prices in the markets that get to be quoted based on demand and supply equilibrium and disequilibrium situations. And then based on changes in the prices, you are able to derive the interest rate or the returns for the assets that you are interested about. Okay, so start always from the prices. When you start gathering the data for your, I often mention the thesis because it's your final target in your studies. And I want to emphasize the importance of all the things that are being taught to you, that you could use those in your thesis work. So when you start gathering your data for your thesis and you're interested about the financial market behavior returns, start from the prices. If you're not absolutely sure, how are the interest rates calculated? Are the interest rates on assets that you're interested, are they based on zero coupon bond markets or are they based on coupon bond markets? Because it's a different thing actually. The information that you take into account in the discounting idea is different. There are lots of more information in the coupon bond markets. Also, the constant coupons have to be discounted to the current value, and the final value has to be discounted. But in the zero coupon markets, it's different. It's just the difference between the dark prices. Logarithmic difference usually. But we will get to these things also in the time series course. But this is the main idea of the whole course, in terms of analyzing the effects of changes in something on the market equilibrium. So it's all about changes in prices. So here is the, once again, a figure on the interest rates. So this is for the short-term money market interest rate. It's a T-bill rate in the US economy. And I have drawn this figure up until 2018 because the corona period is something that is completely different. I already have given you some idea that you should perhaps skip the corona period, even at the stage when you are doing your thesis work, because it's completely, completely different. Okay, so expected inflation and interest rates, we have been used to observe their close connection in the past history. They have a positive correlation. So basically, this comes from the idea of the Fisher hypothesis, actually, that the nominal interest rate should be moving exactly to the same direction as is the expected inflation moving. So basically, when the nominal interest rate goes down, it should be in connection to the similar changes in expected inflations, for example, and we have had these periods up until 2009, that this close connection between expected inflation and interest rate seemed to be holding. But here, since the quotation of zero interest rates in the US markets, this connection clearly has vanished. There is no connection anymore. And the main reason are the unconventional monetary policy actions. And this finding actually was the reason why I tried to do this dividend discount model analysis in the stock markets also, because I realized that the standard discounting ideas might not be working because the real rate of interest might have lost its meaning in the discounting behavior. And it seems to be the case that it has, actually. And in terms of saving the economic, theoretical economic models and normal, let's say, intuitive ideas of economists in terms of functioning of these markets or these ideas, it would be very desirable that we could get rid of this zero lower bound and especially of these negative interest rates. Because they are just in connection to the uncertainty regarding the future. The uncertainty has been going on almost 10 years already in the US and European economies, and it's dictating now everything. Even the profitability of banks, for example, the Finnish OP banks, has started to suffer from this. We will be discussing about the role of net interest income in the banking section, the profit-making section of the banking firm, or the profit-making analysis of the banking firm. But already now, I can say that this continuum of negative interest rates has had a perverse effect on the profitability of banks. It does not come only through the lowering effect of net interest margin. It comes also on the lowering effect of other income items because the activity in the loan markets has decreased quite a lot, even though central banks have been using these unconventional actions. Okay, then the next thing here is to analyze how do these bond markets react to the changes in the real activity, real economic activity. And once again, we start from these positions of blue curves here. So we have once again the supply curve of bonds and the demand curve of bonds. And the first thing that happens here as an exogenous thing is a business cycle expansion. And at the moment, it's very much dictated by the confidential or the confidence of the private sector in all the economies. How do they see the future development of their income? How is the real activity going to be behaving? If they, for some reason or other, see that we might survive from this thing, actually, and the economies could start expanding again, and activity, real economic activity increases, then the individual private agents might, their expectations about the future, their own future might improve. That would be an indicator of a business cycle expansion, actually. And it has an effect on the bond markets. So at first, the firms realized it might be beneficial for them to expand their activities, real activities, production. So the demand or the supply curve of bonds moves to the right. And this comes from the idea that firms think that it's useful for them to expand their activities. And then the second thing that happens here is also that it has an effect on the demand curve of bonds, so it shifts also to the right. So both things here move to these red positions of these curves. So the price of bonds falls and the equilibrium interest rate rises. This would refer to the normal situation, but because we are now experiencing very low levels of interest rates. My argument is that at the first stage of this kind of expansionary expectations of the economy, the interest rates would not increase very much. So the steepness of these curves is nowadays, at the moment, it's much more different compared to this normal situation. You can analyze the quantity of changes in the prices and interest rates. based on the relative steepness of these curves, how steep are these. So smoothening the curve, curvatures of these curves or the slopes of these curves, you can analyze that basically, you can find a result that basically the interest rates might not increase a lot. And especially if the central banks are willing to intervene to the government bond markets, they would have a role there. So they would still be willing to supply more funding for the banking sector, again, buying the government bonds. So it would keep the interest, the price level low, and interest rate would not rise so much. Okay, so these are actually very simple ideas, but these are now actually playing, have a role to play in all the functioning of the markets at the moment. Who are the key players in the markets? In what kind of segments do they play? What is the role of central banks in government funding nowadays? It's a perverse situation. They are funding basically governments, even in their mandates. They should not be doing that, but they are doing that now. So basically, I would very much hope that people, for example, in Finland, we might experience this situation that people, the consumer confidence of the public might be increasing in the future, because people realize that we might survive from this corona actually better than most of the other countries, because our restrictions are very local now. We are not willing to shut down the whole economy anymore. We had an experience from that. It's a disaster. Things go very bad. And we are even more dependent on the international development. So we should not cause any additional problems here in our country, based on our own decision regarding our own economy. So the local restrictions are very good idea. Okay. So, what is the historical relationship between business cycles and interest rates? You see it from here. The shaded areas are the recession periods in the US economy. So the most severe recession was this 2007-2009 recession. And in that connection to that, you see that just before the recession, they had an expansionary period in the real economy. Interest rate was increasing quite steadily because inflationary pressures were high there due to high real economic activity. But then 2008, Lehman Brothers changed everything. And after that, actually, the correlations between various asset market return segments have changed a lot. And most of the explanations for these changes in the correlations come from here, that we have experienced this zero lower bound period of interest rates. And it's now continuing. And in the European level, we went to the gray area of negative interest rates also, which is even more uncommon. Okay, so what is the theoretical model that we can use that comes from the economics theory in this supply and demand analysis in the market for money or other interest yielding assets? It's a Keynesian liquidity preference theory. So if you want to take a look at the standard economic textbooks, start looking for the keyword of liquidity framework. And that just gives you an idea of how to analyze the main categories of assets that people use to store their wealth. And this is very simple classification. You divide just all your wealth to money and bonds. Basically, bonds capture all kinds of assets that you are able to calculate a return based on price quotations. So total wealth is consists of supplied bonds and supplied money. BS and MS here refer to the supply of bonds and supply of money. In equilibrium, it should be equal to the demand of bonds and to the demand plus the demand of money. So if we want to analyze the equilibrium situation in these two separate markets, then arrange this that the bond market variables are on the left-hand side. So here we have, if this difference is zero, then we have an equilibrium. Then if it's not zero, then we might have, if it's positive, then we have an excess supply. If it's negative, we have an excess demand. Okay? If supply is bigger than demand, in the bond markets, we have excess supply. If demand is bigger than supply, we have excess demand, referring to that bigger earlier. And at the aggregate economic level in equilibrium, the disequilibrium in the bond markets should correspond to the disequilibrium in the money markets. Okay? So the difference between the money supply and the money demand, and usually we define these in terms of the M2 that we discussed yesterday. So if the money market is in equilibrium, the supply equals demand, and if the bond market is in equilibrium, the supply equals demand. And we can have excess supply or excess demand in both markets, but they should add up to zero. And excess supply in the money markets is referring to the excess supply, excess demand in the bond markets, actually. Okay, so let's start doing this analysis. And the first thing in terms of the money markets that is different from the bond markets that we analyzed previously is here that the amount of money is completely dictated by the central bank. So it's a vertical line. The supply line of money is a vertical line there. Based on the decisions of the central bank, it can either use expansionary monetary policy action, which means that it will move the supply curve to the right, or it can use contractionary monetary policy action, which means that it will decrease the supply of money. So this vertical line goes to the left. But the things regarding the demand for money are basically the same as the in the demand for bonds. So once again, you have to realize here that we draw this now in terms of only the interest rate, because the interest rate is the thing that the central bank can have an effect on. So basically, in the money markets, the price of money is interest rate. Now, this is a bit confusing thing, but in the standard literature, we are talking about the price of money in terms of the interest rate. And that just comes from the simple idea that if the liquidity preference idea says that if you want to have more money in your holdings in the form of cash for your consumption purposes, so your liquidity preference is high, so you are willing to accept the fact that you are losing some interest yield from your savings or your bond holdings because you want to consume more. You want to have more money, and the money is not in standard terms. It's not yielding any interest yield to you. It's a zero interest rate holding. You only use that for the purposes of consumption. So we are talking in economic terms, we are talking about an opportunity cost of holding more money. So that's important for you. You want to have more money, so you are willing to sacrifice the interest rate or the interest yield that you would have gained from investing that money, additional money to the interest-earning asset market. Do you understand this idea? That gives you a very loose idea of why we define the interest rate as a price of money. It resembles the opportunity cost in terms of the lost interest yield from interest yielding assets. Okay, so the key variable here is now the interest rate when we talk about the money market situation. Demand for money in the liquidity preference framework is dependent on the interest rate. And when the interest rate increases, the opportunity cost of holding money increases. And the relative expected return of money decreases. Do you understand this now? Just consider these two things. They are actually, this is actually something that you can even use for your understanding regarding the role of negative interest rates. If you think that nowadays in the banking sector, we are heavily discussing about the possibility of paying negative deposit interest rates to the customers. Some of the banks in the Nordic markets are already paying actually to the big customers for large amounts of deposits. They are paying a small negative interest rate. And that they accept that because they have no alternatives for those excess funds at the moment. They think that that bank is still the safest possible place for your huge amounts of cash. So even though you have to pay a fee for that you are depositing your own money to the bank, you are willing to accept that. They see no alternatives for that. One of the reasons is that the bond markets are now in a very strange situation. The interest rates from the bond markets are even lower, more negative. So it's a smaller opportunity cost actually to hold your cash in the deposits or deposit accounts that pay a small negative interest rate. So you have to pay a fee for having those cash amounts in the deposit account. Okay, so you can analyze this thing also, the current situation, in this liquidity preference framework. But immediately when the government bond markets start experiencing positive interest rates, it might be the case that also the money market interest rate would start increasing. And if we had adopted this sovereign individual country policy in this funding operations for this corona crisis, we could have observed positive interest rates in the government markets. And that might have helped also the money markets to get to the normal situation of positive interest rates. Why didn't we use this possibility? I'm very puzzled about this, but I'm just the one minor, not so small professor, but minor professor that has an own opinion about these things. So the public press is not willing to bring out this at the moment, but we should have perhaps used this possibility or taken a look at this first. We could have had these European Union level rescue packets there as a readily planned thing. In terms of collateral for the individual country sovereign debts. And then get to the markets after we would have noticed that the sovereign markets are not working in a proper way. And the interest yields are rising too much. But we didn't do that. We are not doing that at the moment, but I would have very much hoped that we could have done that. Okay, so we have these, once again, we are analyzing the factors that have an effect on the equilibrium interest rates in this liquidity preference framework, but now we are analyzing the demand for money. And the interest rate is the opportunity cost of holding more money. So you have to bear this in mind when you start to analyze the effects of other variables that have an effect on the demand for money. So we have the income effect. If there is a rise in the income, so higher income levels, they cause the demand for money at each interest rate to increase through to the liquidity preference. We assume that the goods are normal goods. So if you have more income, you are willing to consume more. So you need more liquidity and the demand curve shifts to the right. So demand for money increases. And then we have the price level effect. Once again, rise in the price level causes the demand for money at each interest rate to increase because you have to use more money for purchases. For the same amount of purchases, you have to use more money if you're not willing to sacrifice your consumption levels. You have to use money to be able to satisfy your consumption needs at the higher prices. So once again, the demand curve shifts to the right. So these are the key things that have an effect. What are the things that have an effect on the supply of money? Bear in mind all the time that the single supplier, legal supplier of official money is the central bank. The supply curve is vertical. So it's completely controlled by the central bank. An increase in the money supply engineered by any central bank, not just Federal Reserve, but all the central banks, will shift the supply curve for money to the right. So here, once again, we collect all the things to the same table. All the relevant variables that have an effect on the money demand and also on the money supply. So what is an effect on the interest rate? Income has an effect on money demand, especially, so it will move the demand curve to the right. If income increases, if the price level increases, the same happens. The demand curve will shift to the right, and the equilibrium interest rate. I have not highlighted in this table that we have to always discuss about the equilibrium interest rate. So the equilibrium interest rate is the one that we get from the crossing of demand curve and the supply curve. It increases in both these cases, and in the last case, when the money supply increases, then it's analogous to the lowering interest rates. And this is actually has happened throughout the history in the central bank world, also during the unconventional monetary policy period. We first hit the lower zero bound in the US because the US Federal Reserve decided that it will not allow negative interest rates in the money market horizon or the maturities. But in the European case, the main refinancing operations, interest rates, or main refinancing operations was allowed to go negative. And that was the signal to the banking sector in general, that also the interbank asset quotations in the Euribor markets went negative. So the central bank made the decision that it's allowing these negative interest rates. Okay, so if there comes a response, there comes a change in the income or the price level, then first a rise in income or the price level shifts the money demand curve right, and the equilibrium interest rate rises. And if there comes a change in the money supply, then the demand curve stays the same. Originally, the increase in the money supply just shifts the supply curve to the right. But nevertheless, remember here that it has an effect on the interest rate also, so it lowers the interest rate. Once again, simple demand and supply curve, but compared to the bond markets, the supply curve is different. It's completely, the position of supply curve is completely dictated by the central bank. It determines this x-axis variable, the quantity, completely. But in the bond markets, the situation was different. We have this normal situation of supply and demand curves because it depends on the incentives of the individual bond market participants, the firms that need the funding through the bond markets. They are able to accept that they can only get a certain amount of funding at certain price, and depends on the demand for those ones. But in these markets, it's a different situation because central bank has the legal right to be the only supplier of money. Okay. So a one-time increase in the money supply will cause prices to rise to a permanently higher level by the end of the year, normally, but this doesn't hold in the current situation. It has not actually been working for almost 10 years already, at least not in a one-to-one relationship like we used to observe that in early years, before the global financial crisis. So the Fisher hypothesis or the Fisher relationship held more tightly before the global financial crisis, and since that, it has more and more like vanished due to the introduction of these unconventional monetary policy actions. For some reason or other, the additional liquidity through the money markets and extensions of these buying programs of central banks is not channeled to real activity and inflation in real economies anymore. And it's something that is puzzling the economists at the moment. Okay, but we still should be able to analyze all these things in the framework of liquidity prevalence theory. So it leads to the conclusion that an increase in the money supply will lower interest rates. It is denoted to be the liquidity effect. An income effect finds that interest rates are rising because increasing the money supply is an expansionary influence on the economy. So demand curve will shift to the right. In normal circumstances, these things have been working beautifully, but under unconventional monetary policy situations, they are not holding so strongly anymore. And I would very much like to get rid of this situation, that the standard theories are not working at all. Uncertainty has the biggest role to play in everything now. So why didn't we use those individual sovereign bond markets to this? Or why are we not using them? Because it would have been the possibility to get rid of, because the default premium between the countries in the euro area, that they are completely different. Corona just by chance introduced this possibility of different default premium in the euro area countries. So we would have observed much more variation in the government bond market yields or interest rates, even at different maturities, because the country risks are so different now due to Corona. I'm very much a market model oriented economist, and it seems to be that, at least for the case of current Finnish government, it's not the thing that they want to too much advocate, or even at the European Union level. Okay. So that's a higher rate of growth of the money supply, lower interest rates. Oh, there are guidelines coming again. So the price level effect predicts an increase in the money supply, leads to a rise in interest rates in response to the rise in the price level. These are the same thing that we have been discussing many times already here. But the expected inflation effects shows an increase in interest rates because an increase in the money supply may lead people to expect a higher price level in the future. So expected inflations are and actual inflations are very much connected to each other. And even nowadays, we obviously see that the expected inflation is almost the same as the actual inflation, because inflation does not vary very much at the moment. Okay, but nevertheless, we can analyze the effects of these guys in the liquidity preference framework when we want to analyze the equilibrium situations in the bond yielding asset, in the interest yielding asset markets, i.e. bond markets, and in the money markets. Use the liquidity preference framework for that. So here we have the various possibilities for the analysis regarding the various effects that have an effect, or the various factors that have an effect on the interest rate. If the liquidity effect is larger than other effects, then it will result into a situation that when there comes to a shock in the money, when there comes a shock in the money supply, so there's an expansionary monetary policy action, so the central bank increases the supply of M2, basically, lowers the interest rate, basically, it could be the same thing. But it will have these kind of effects. So the liquidity effect is the first that starts to play there. It lowers the interest rate. And then the income price level and expected inflation levels start to work in the longer term. And we might end up, or usually we have ended up in the past history before global financial crisis and also Corona into a situation that the actual longer term change in the interest rate was not so strong as the first reaction to the money supply. And in this case, when the liquidity effect is smaller than other effects and slow adjustment of expected inflation, we may end up to a situation where the interest rate increases more permanently in the longer term, but only after it has gone through all these various stages in the effect. And then finally, if the liquidity effect is smaller than expected inflation effect and fast adjustment of expected inflation, then the people realize that this monetary expansion is something that will for sure affect to the interest yielding asset markets and more permanently, then there's basically very small effect regarding the liquidity needs of the people. And all that we see basically is dictated based on income and price level effects. So the interest rate increases quite a lot. So there's a big increase in interest rate compared to these two cases when the liquidity effect is smaller than all the other effects, and there's a fast adjustment of expected inflation. So this would refer to a situation that we probably assumed in the introduction of unconventional monetary policy actions. Though they wanted to increase the liquidity in the markets suddenly, if the markets would have worked in the normal way, and uncertainty would not have played such a huge role, we would have observed basically a situation in the longer term that the price levels would have started to increase and expected inflation would have increased quite a lot and interest rates would have gone up. But the uncertainty was way too much in the, because one of the individual reasons is the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. It was thought to be something that should never go into bankruptcy. And it launched a huge chain of reactions through the international banking markets because they realized that the subprime crisis is something that is expanding to Europe also because of the international holdings of the European banks, of the US banks. And no one understood what kind of assets did they originally have in the balance sheets. They were too sophisticated assets even for very experienced bankers to understand. Too much changes in the ownership during the introduction of these assets. That's a completely new, very complicated form of assets that seemed to have a collateral, but it was exposed that they didn't actually have any collateral. And that originated in the housing market innovations. But you can analyze these things basically when we get rid of this complete uncertainty situation that is now dictating also these standard theories at the moment. When the stock market volatility starts in longer terms to smoothen out, we have seen a very strong first, we saw a total collapse around March, and now a huge rise. And now, at the moment, the US markets are going down once again. So the volatility is really very high. That's not an indication of lowering uncertainty at all. The same applies to the macroeconomic uncertainty indicators. They are very high at the moment. For example, economic policy uncertainty index that we will be discussing also in the monetary policy section. Is very high at the moment. So the general uncertainty regarding the effects of economic policies is very high. Macroeconomic prospect indicators are very, very poor at the moment. So uncertainty is huge. We can say safely that these beautiful ideas of of liquidity preference framework in the interest-selling asset markets. They are not working at all. But they should be. I would very much like to save these because they are very intuitive. They are based on simple behavior of the economic agents in terms of we just want to consume and we want to invest and we want to compare the investment returns to each other for the purposes of increasing the future consumption possibilities in terms of real-term consumption. It's not working. I hate this. I don't like this at all. But hopefully we can get rid of this, let's say, in a couple of years of time so that things would be getting more normal. Okay. It's the usual case that I'm very excited about discussing these things because these are so nicely connected to the things that are happening in the real world at the moment. You can analyze these things or discuss these things based on these standard theories. Theories are not working at the moment because the uncertainty is so huge about everything. But these are the underlying ideas that should be working, usually. Okay, once again, we have lost. The last slide here is about the connection between the money growth and interest rates. So each and every time when the money growth increased a lot, it was in connection to lowering interest rate in the past history, but not anymore after the global financial crisis. And this is strongly irritating to me. I don't like this at all. But this is something that we have to discuss in more detail. And this is the reason why I want to do lots of analysis in your home assignments, for example, regarding how to get rid of this unconventional monetary policy actions or the situation. There is some new recent research and I will introduce that to you. You are able to give your own ideas based on these things that we are discussing here and the most recent research. Okay, I think that's pretty much the material for this week that we have now gone through. So we will continue from this. Take a look at these slides regarding the zero lower bound and negative interest rates. And we will go these through next week. But then when you go to this term structure of interest rate part here, that is the slides from 130. I will send these instructions also through Moodle, but the slides from 137 to 155, you should read those independently, and you can read those actually before the next week's first lecture. So slides 137 until 155, all about term structure of interest rates. That actually gives you an idea of how perverse is the situation now in the negative interest rate markets that we are now experiencing in terms of the historical or theoretical ideas. We will discuss about these negative interest rates at the first lecture next week.